Julie Solomon, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I literally want to start at the very beginning of this book and ask you about the title. I don't think I've ever asked an author that right off the bat, but it's called Hospital, and then the subtitle is Man, Woman, Birth, Death, Infinity, Plus Red Tape, Bad Behavior, Money, God, and Diversity on Steroids. How did you come up with that?
Well, I came up with it through the back door. Originally, at the very beginning, my editor wanted to call the book Hospital. And I said, that's too boring, Hospital. You know, I'm tired of these one-word titles. So then I spent months trying to come up with, the idea was to come up with some poetic title and then have A Year in the Life of an American Hospital as the subtitle. Finally, all the titles didn't work. Everybody hated all of them, or some of them. So one day she called me, she said, let's flip it around. Let's go back to Hospital and then come up with a subtitle. So I was frantically, because we were getting near the deadline, frantically trying to come up with something. And one night, late at night, when my daughter was 18 now, was very small, I used to watch old Ben Casey reruns in the middle of the night, and the Man, Woman, Birth, Death, Life, Infinity was at the beginning of the show, Dr. Zorba.
Right.
And I thought, well, and then I just added all that other stuff, bad behavior, money, God, and diversity on steroids, red tape, because that's what I'd seen in my year at the hospital. So I typed this out to my editor, and I got back an email from her a few hours later saying, I may be punch drunk in the middle of the night, but I love this. And that's what it ended up being.
And tell us what you did. You spent a year in the life of the hospital. Which hospital, and how much access did you really have?
I spent a year at Maimonides Medical Center in Brooklyn. It's a big hospital, 705 beds. That puts it in the top 5% of hospitals in America. How I got there was through a long series of coincidences, which I won't go into now, but they sort of led me to this hospital in Brooklyn. And what intrigued me about it was, I've written about different aspects of culture for most of my professional life, and what really intrigued me about Maimonides was it was a hospital that was started to serve the Jewish community of Brooklyn 100 years ago, an immigrant community. And now 100 years later, it's still a kosher hospital, but now 80% of the patients are from everywhere. The hospital advertises itself as 67 languages spoken here.
It is a true melting pot there.
A true melting pot. And I felt that just when I first heard about the hospital, all the kinds of issues of modern life seemed to devolve into this one place. Multiculturalism, technology versus humanity, what's it like to live in the post 9/11 world when the melting pot is a different thing than it was pre-2001. And as it turned out, the president of the hospital, Pam Breyer, had always wanted to write a book about hospitals, and she had read a couple of my books, liked my writing. And so when I made this really pretty outrageous proposition, I want to spend a year at your hospital. They were starting a new cancer center, so the idea was that I would follow the progress of this cancer center. I want to have complete access, and I'll let you read the book when it comes out.
You were asking for the moon.
And they gave it to you.
And
they gave it to me. They didn't just hand it over. It took several months. I was working at the time as a reporter at the New York Times, so in my off hours, I'd go out to Brooklyn. I live in Manhattan, and have negotiations with different people. And I think they started to hear what my idea was in doing the book and were intrigued by it.
And what did you tell them? What did you want to find out?
What were you looking for? You know, I didn't know specifically, but I think what I wanted to do was, you know, several years ago, I'd written a book called The Devil's Candy, where I spent a year on the set of Brian De Palma's Bonfire of the Vanities, where he turned Tom Wolfe's novel into a movie. And what I tried to do in that book was to look at what the reality of the movie-making process is. There's a lot of PR, there's a lot of razzle-dazzle, but what's the actual process like? And in the course of that book, the movie was a tremendous flop, and so it was quite interesting. And in this case, we hear a lot about healthcare. We hear a lot about healthcare policy. We hear a lot of horror stories of patients maligned by the system. But I think very few people are really aware of what goes on in this big, complex organism that is a hospital. And I had the audacity now in retrospect, because I don't even think I knew what I was getting into, but I wanted to look at the organism. How does this thing operate? And I guess my idea from the beginning was to look at it almost as you would look at a novel, with a bunch of different characters and different aspects of it. But what is their work like? What are the obstacles to trying to do the thing they're trying to do, which is to deliver health care? And that was really what I sold the book as, and I think that's what the book actually is.
In another industry, it would be called a book that is very character-driven.
Yes.
This is all about the characters who populate the hospital in the executive rooms and in the patient rooms.
That's right, because I think what we tend to forget, and I think one of the reasons, you know, I went on the websites of all the political candidates to look at healthcare policy, and a lot of times your eyes just glaze over. Unless you're in the healthcare business or a policy person, it's very hard often for lay people to understand what these things mean. When you talk about bureaucratic entanglements or Medicaid payments or DRGs, all this kind of technical terminology that's used, the average person doesn't know what it means. And what we really don't know what it means to the people working in that industry. And to even call it an industry is such a funny idea. Mm-hmm. This is delivering medical care.
And I'm not sure where you want to start with this question, but when you step back from it, we so often hear the healthcare system is broken. What did you find broken? What did you find worked well?
It's a big question.
I know.
Well, broken is just this at some point along the way, the system got perverted. So now what I would find is that at the hospital, take a very simple example. It used to be that in the finance office, they dealt with 7 different insurance payers, or maybe 5. Now they deal with 25. They all have different requirements. There is something very wrong when the first question asked of a patient when they're about to go to the hospital, unless they go through the emergency room, is, who's your insurance carrier? That's the wrong first question. It should be, what's wrong with you? And so that's terribly broken. And I don't mean to say that money hasn't always been a part of medicine, but like money everywhere else in our society, the profit motive has just ratcheted up. And where are most of the profits going? This isn't really so much a part of my book, but it's lurking in the background, because patients are, you know, there's an intensity to move patients through the system. And I have a whole chapter called Safety Nets, which really tracks what takes so long for a patient to get from the emergency room into a hospital bed, and then what's the process of getting the patient from that bed through the system, i.e. trying to cure what ails them, and then getting them discharged. So you see nurse after nurse after nurse who used to work at bedside now working behind computers, working on, is there a rehab place that will take this patient's insurance so that we can discharge them? And why is it so important to get them through the system? Because the insurance payments vary according to how long the patient stays in the hospital. So that's one thing that's terribly broken.
And again, the characters you focused on, what were their responses to what you've just described? Acceptance? Pushback? Frustration?
All of the above. And then the flip side of it is, this is where the system is really broken. On the one hand, there's this incredible push to move patients through the system. Then I focus on a patient called Mr. Zen, an illegal immigrant, a guy who shows up in the emergency room, a 41-year-old man with a horrible cancer. He'd never been to a primary care doctor, and he spends months in the hospital building up an over $1 million bill, which will never be paid because he's uninsured. And so the disconnect of reality is just kind of crazy. And what that $1 million bill means, that other patients won't get treatment, or they'll be stressed out. Not that he shouldn't get treatment, but there's an irrationality built into the system. And I think with the characters, what you would see is just the stress. There's a chapter called The Code of Mutual Respect. And what it's about is, that's something else that's broken. The way there's so much pressure on everybody from morning until night, financial pressure, medical pressure, fear of malpractice, that people start misbehaving towards one another. And one of the major goals of the hospital president, and it sounds crazy, is to get the doctors, nurses, staff people to to be civil to one another. And as crazy as that sounds, the lack of respect is something else that's broken in the hospital. Lack of respect for patients, for their doctors and their nurses, vice versa. And the level of the sense of stress and harassment is sort of out of control.
And do you think that the hospital made progress in trying to fix that problem during your time there, or in the almost 2 years since you left the hospital?
I do. And at first I was very dubious because they had actual courses. It was a course requirement that once a week the entire perioperative staff would have to take this training. It was on hospital time. And at first, everybody was incredibly dubious, and especially me, because it was sort of in this, you know, management guru babble kind of talk, and I was very skeptical of it. But I think what it did was force people to step back and think about their own behavior, because when this is sort of to answer what goes right, what astonished me throughout was how many people in the hospital, under all this stress and very difficult work, they really cared. I mean, that was the thing that even the ones who were the biggest jerks sometimes and who were concerned about money too much and did get involved in crazy feuds, they really did somewhere in their hearts care a lot about patients and care a lot about doing their jobs really well. And I think if you ask again what's broken, it's one of the doctors says that at a certain point, insurance companies reimburse you for procedures, which is why operations and radiation and all of those kind of technology-driven pieces of medicine are very popular, but you don't get paid for being a doctor, mm-hmm. for sitting there and talking, for getting to know your patient. And so one of the things that worked very well there was one of the doctors I was following, Dr. Astro, is very concerned about these issues of spirituality, of being a good person, for lack of a better term, and he would meet every week with the fellows in his program for a program that had actually been started by another doctor called Biopsychosocial. And what they focused on were the psychosocial parts.
And you were skeptical about that.
And I was skeptical about that, but every week you would meet with these doctors, nurses, social workers, and they would bring up patients' cases, not so much to talk about the illness part, even though that also informed the discussion, but to find out what were the other pressures coming to bear on that patient. What were they thinking about? What was it? Was it a single mother with two young? One of the cases was a single mother with two young kids who had cancer. And watching these young doctors realize that, yes, part of their job is to be good technicians and read x-rays and do procedures, but they also have to perform this much harder function of actually caring for somebody who's sick.
And were you able to see examples of where that kind of seminar played itself out in the patients' rooms?
Very much so throughout. I mean, there was the one case that I followed, which was this young woman with the two children, and it was incredibly moving because she didn't speak English, so translators were involved, and the young doctors going through, you could see that all of this was making an imprint on them. And these were, Maimonides is a teaching hospital, so one of the things that came out over and over again in my conversations with the young doctors who I followed through the system was you could see these things were making an imprint on them, whether they realized it so much then at that moment, you felt these people will be better doctors for this. These will be better nurses for this later on. Now, they also were very blunt in their opinions, you know, about multiculturalism and, you know, they were very blunt about their feelings about their patients not speaking English. So I'm not, you know, this is real life. So it's not all, you know, sweet talk and roses. But I think what I saw there very vividly were how the kinds of things we hear about in sort of broad technical terms played out on the ground with real people. And it's all not just romance as it is on Grey's Anatomy. You know, they actually do something besides flirt with each other.
Right. Although part of your book did have to deal with the personal lives of some of the people
Absolutely.
At the hospital, particularly the administrators. And I guess the point you were trying to make was that to a certain degree, hospitals reflect the personalities, the priorities of the people who lead them. Can you give us an example of that?
Many examples. In fact, so many examples that I started to think that I had wandered into a movie set, because the guy who, the doctor, who's the medical director of the hospital, is an oncologist. His dream forever was to start this cancer center. During the year I was at the hospital, his own wife had cancer and was dying of cancer and ultimately dies. And when he was talking to me about what it's like to be a doctor, not just a doctor, an oncologist, and have to watch and diagnose and try not to interfere but can't help but interfere in your own wife's treatment, and your attitudes towards what good medical care, how it changes you. One of the reasons he wanted to start the cancer center so badly, his wife had had an earlier bout of breast cancer, which she came through very well several years before, and it was then that he realized the hospital's radiation facilities were horrible. And so it took that personal moment of being on the other side of the bed to make him realize what it was. The hospital president, 2 weeks before she took over as president, she had been the number two to the previous president. She and her husband were in an absolute life-threatening car accident. Her husband broke, they thought, 28 or 29 bones in his body. She couldn't walk well for months and months and still has pain left over from this accident, which was now 5 years ago. And she had been a patient a lot. And a lot of the things that sometimes seemed to me sort of like small things, she would go insane if she saw, not go insane, but she would get really angry if she saw a hospital worker who didn't have their badge displayed. But then she said, you know, when you're lying in a
door,
or dirty door, or dirty floor is even worse. But she said, you know, when you're lying in bed in a hospital room and somebody comes in and they start asking you a bunch of questions or tell you to take your clothes off and they don't identify themselves, you don't know who they are, it's very frightening and it's very frustrating. And I think a lot of her attitudes towards medical care were very much informed by her own experience as a patient. She finally read the book a couple of weeks ago, and she was mortified because there's a section in the book about constipation. She declared herself the foremost expert on constipation in the borough of Brooklyn, and she as a patient said that's one of the dirty little secrets nobody talks about in a hospital. When people are in the hospital, they suffer from constipation. Nobody wants to talk about it. Pain medication, how it's a very controversial subject in hospitals. You know, how much are you supposed to suck it up, and how much are you supposed, because you might become addicted, it slows down the recovery process, and how much are you not supposed to suffer?
Julie, I want to ask you something that takes you outside of the book per se.
Sure.
We're in the middle of a presidential campaign. You mentioned it a moment ago. Having spent the year that you did, do you find a connection between what the candidates talk about as healthcare policy proposals and the reality on the ground of the healthcare system, or is there a disconnect?
I think both. I think the disconnect, I think, is that, yes, you know, whether you talk about a single-payer system or universal health coverage, whether it's Hillary Clinton's plan that it's mandatory or Barack Obama's plan that it's not mandatory except for children, that's all well and good. It doesn't solve the problem in the hospital. It's great to have more people insured, but it means more people are coming in. And so I think, as with any kind of big sweeping change, every action sets off a million opposite and unexpected reactions. And I think, you know, it's too complicated probably to talk about on the road, but they may not even realize it. I mean, in Massachusetts, they're already having that situation where they've put in universal health care. And there was a story in the Times a couple of weeks ago that now you can't get in to see a primary health care physician because they're overwhelmed with people making appointments, doing what they're supposed to do. Nobody wants to address the really hard truth, which is how do you encourage people to go into the medical profession? People don't want to become doctors and nurses because they don't get the same respect. They often graduate from medical school with bills up the wazoo that they can never pay off, while their classmates go off and become investment bankers and make a zillion dollars. And so I think that as important as, yes, universal health care coverage is wonderful, but then are we going to then bite the bullet and say, this is something very important. This is as important as national defense. This is as important as anything else, that we have to allocate the resources to take care of all those extra people who are going to be coming into the system.
I have a final question. I do want to bring it back around to the book. It was one of the final questions you pose in the book, and it was one that was asked of you by Dr. Ostro. Looking back on your intense year in this challenging hospital, did you know what you were getting into?
Absolutely not. You know, I think that, I think as foolish as it sounds, I certainly didn't anticipate the amount of emotion that I would feel, how many people would die, which was really crazy for me not to realize that. I was following an oncologist around, and one thing that's happened in hospitals in the last few years with the advance in medicine that allows so many procedures to be taken care of as outpatients,
right,
it means that people in hospital tend to be much sicker. And so I wasn't anticipating how sick people were going to be. So that was on the one hand. On the other hand, and this may sound terrible, I didn't realize how exciting it would be. You know, these are people, both patients and doctors and nurses and technicians, who are, they're really living on the edge. You know, they're working in it. They're working in a profession that actually means something. And I guess for me, the sad thing was, is that sometimes the pressures that come to bear, and because in society we don't value taking care of our sick, just like we don't value our teachers in the same way we should. These are the old pillars of the community. This is a pillar of the community. And so to sort of bring together my book and your question about the larger healthcare system, Marty Payson, who's the chairman of the hospital, said something very profound at the end. And we've seen it in New Orleans. We've seen it where the healthcare system was destroyed, that we can talk about national healthcare policy, but the truth is healthcare is still local, it's personal, and we shouldn't forget that. And I think that sometimes that's something that does get lost in the equation, that communities do have responsibility to take care of their sick.
Okay, thank you so much. Julie Solomon, author of Hospital. Thanks.
Thanks so much.